is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhibi in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's been too much. And we're getting sick because of stress. This electricity thing is stressing us as elderly people. We don't have any hope.
That's 66-year-old Cecilia Delpu in a Soweto township in Johannesburg, among many South Africans suffering from the winter cold due to chronic power outages. Details coming up. Also, 24 million voters are eligible to take part in tomorrow's Algerian's parliamentary election. And there is another school kidnapping in northern Nigeria. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The United States and the European Union held a virtual roundtable event yesterday to discuss the ongoing humanitarian crisis that is unfolding in Ethiopia's Tigray region. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, gave the opening remarks. International Edition's Steve Miller caught up with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir, who told him the ambassador started off by saying that the international community could not let Ethiopia starve.
Saying we cannot let Ethiopia starve, we need to act now. And she was quite angry, actually, at her colleagues on the UN Security Council, because the council has been largely silent on the situation. They've had a handful of private meetings. They've put out a statement or two, but they haven't really applied the pressure that they have in their toolbox to kind of bring the fighting to a halt and let aid workers into the areas where they need to be and to do the things that need to be done to contain and reverse what's becoming a huge man-made disaster.
Margaret, prior to today's meeting, the World Food Program released a video. And in that video, Maria Santamaria, who is the World Food Program head of program and operations in English, is in Mokele, said that what's going on in the region prior to the conflict has been affected by the shocks in recent years.
We had the desert locust this past year, hailstorms, some pockets of the region that are already chronically affected by drought. It means that this is an area that's already a bit on the edge. And so now with the conflict, the disruption of health systems, the collapse of markets in many areas, the inability to plant today because people don't have access to seeds, fertilizer, or the security to be able to plant, means that for WFP, the number one priority is going to continue to be that humanitarian assistance until the situation allows people to resume their livelihoods activities and meet their own food security needs.
So, Margaret, what kind of details can you share with our listeners about what was discussed in today's meeting?
Well, the current situation is shocking. There are 350,000 people in Tigray who are already in famine conditions, not slipping into famine, but there. And there are 2 million more people who are just a step away from that level of food insecurity. And then below them, there are even more people who are in an emergency state, but, you know, in one step behind them. So you have this index where they chart based on different variables how serious the situation is. But there are already 350,000 men, women, and children who are in famine conditions. And it's not just in Tigray. The humanitarians were clear about saying that there's also really serious situations going on in Afar and in Amhara and across Ethiopia, because as the World Food Program lady pointed out, because of the locusts and the drought and such, there are 16 million people who are in food insecurity situations across Ethiopia. So it's a major problem, not just from the conflict.
So moving forward, what kind of action items or next steps were discussed?
Well, there was a big call from both the humanitarian representatives and from the Western diplomats there for a humanitarian ceasefire to happen for Tigray so that aid workers can reach people in the most remote and hard to reach areas. And there was also a big call for money to scale up the operation. And there the G7 group of nations are meeting right now in England. And so this meeting was sort of at the same time as that, I think, to highlight a bit. And President Biden has said the situation in Tigray will be on his agenda when he meets with his counterparts there. And there was definitely a call for the G7 to take action, to do something to prevent this getting worse. And there is a concern that by September, another 400,000 people could slip into these catastrophic famine conditions if there isn't immediate assistance.
That was VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with International Edition's Steve Miller. The UN's Children's Fund is working with the World Food Program and the Food and Agriculture Organization to provide nutrition, healthcare, and clean water support in Ethiopia's Tigray region. UNICEF spokesman James Elder says an estimated 33,000 severely malnourished children in currently inaccessible areas in Tigray are at a high risk of death. Meanwhile, he said, Mozambique's Cabo Delgado region is suffering a children's crisis from a deadly mixture of climate change, conflict, and COVID-19. Elder said more than 220 schools reportedly have come under attack and targeted assaults by armed groups have displaced a third of the population in the region. About 24 million voters are eligible to take part in Algeria's parliamentary elections tomorrow, which are perceived as the latest attempt by President Abdelmadjid Tebboune's administration to claim a mantle of legitimacy. Parliamentary elections in 2017 produced two winners, the ruling National Liberation Front, FLN, and National Democratic Rally, NDR parties. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi asked William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, whether the new elections could produce a different outcome.
Not from 35,000 feet. So the big picture is the following. The Herak forced out the president in 2019. And even a year ago, the new president was talking about the blessed Herak, who had done the nation a service by forcing out his invalid predecessor, who had been surrounded by large levels of corruption, which was acknowledged by the regime. Now the system has reasserted itself. Crackdown is going on civil society. People are starting to be released from jail who were arrested in 2019. And the same parties and forces that supported Bouteflika and his apparatus are now supporting Tebboune and his apparatus. Now, the RND, the second party you mentioned, is mostly just a spin-off of the FLN. And this two-party duopoly has been the main force in Algerian politics for over two decades. And of course, the FLN has been the main force for over six decades. The other force that everyone's talking about in this election are the Islamists. And the Islamists are participating through the MSP party and some other smaller parties. And there's a lot of either happiness in Algeria that at least they're participating as they did during the Bouteflika era, or they're scared that the Islamists are going to win a lot of seats and, you know, create havoc in the parliament. But these Islamists are, you know, what you might call very pro-regime Islamists who get along with the duopoly. So they really, despite all the sort of scary coverage in the press, they're really not going to upset the system at all. Now, the rise of independence could change the complexion of parliament, but it'll create a more disorganized parliament, not a more organized parliament. And you'll have these complicated coalitions like we get in some other countries now, where you'll have five, six, seven, eight parties and then a bunch of independents cobbled together to try to accomplish things. But that's kind of fragmented and disorganized politics really doesn't serve the people very well.
But the real problem is which way Algeria is going. After Herak, everyone was hopeful that this movement will change the political scene in Algeria. But over time, it's not.
Well, as I've told you before, by working so hard to co-opt and coerce the political parties and the NGOs, the regime forces politics into the streets. Then the only changes come when there's more street protest, right? And that happened in 88, it happened in 91, it happened in 2011, 2017, 2019. I mean, there are different times where you have these spikes of protests and a certain amount of change happens. And even in 2021, you know, the Harak picked up again. And there was, that's what forced these elections, right? They're spot elections, you know, snap elections because of the increased protest. But then the regime banned street protests, right, in the run-up to the elections and because of COVID. So, you know, the regime has the upper hand right now. The elections will happen, you know, and then there'll be more street protests later, but we don't know when.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy. One student was killed and another wounded when gunmen raided a school in northern Nigeria late yesterday and kidnapped at least 10 pupils. According to Reuters, the gunmen attacked the main campus of the Nuhu Bamali Polytechnic School in Zaria in Kaduna State. The state's commissioner of internal security, Samuel Aruan, said the kidnappers have yet to make any ransom demand. Worsening electricity cuts are causing outrage in South Africa, where residents are again going hours without electricity at a time that a series of cold fronts had people shivering in their homes. Experts warn that the power cuts are stifling economic growth and hurting security in hospitals. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
66-year-old Cecilia Lepu lives in Pinville, Soweto Township in Johannesburg. Spending hours without electricity during winter has just been unbearable.
It's been long now. It's been too much. And we're getting sick because of stress. This electricity thing is stressing us as elderly people. We don't have any hope.
South Africa State Power Utility Eskom is making cuts called load shedding. This means taking up to 4,000 megawatts off the grid, leaving citizens and businesses in the dark. The utility is pointing fingers at its aging power plant, constant breakdowns, maintenance schedules and financial challenges. Sikonati Manjanja is the spokesperson at Eskom.
These constraints have been exacerbated by the high winter demand. This has resulted in reserves being depleted, reducing available capacity. Breakdowns currently total 13,752 megawatts of capacity, while plant maintenance is 1,200 megawatts.
No sector of the economy or life has been spared by these blackouts. Daphne Crook from River Lee in Johannesburg entirely depends on assisted oxygen to breathe. And that needs electricity to power it up.
If I just get off the oxygen, then I'm blue. My hands, my mouth, my feet, everything is blue because my body haven't got oxygen. When load shedding happen, then I'm mad. 2 minutes, the bottle will be finished. I can't stay without oxygen, without the bottle.
Gledwin Malisha, president of the Durban Chamber of Commerce and Industry, says the blackout's impact on the economy is dire.
If you have now this load shedding coming to stage four, you are losing productivity, people can't come and buy. The only thing that you do is to cut the cost, and your cost will be employees. And that is actually a problem because it affects employment rate. And also, if we do that, it means that we're increasing the levels of crime.
Mobile network providers are battling to keep people connected. Criminals are having a field day as their activities thrive best in the dark. But there is now light at the end of the tunnel. President Cyril Ramaphosa just announced that independent power producers, including big businesses, will be allowed to produce up to 100 megawatts, up from only one as currently allowed by law.
This reform is expected to unlock significant investment in new generation capacity in the short and medium term, and it will enable companies to build their own generation facilities to supply their energy needs.
However, experts warn this could take 6 to 24 months before it makes a difference. This means darker days for those who cannot afford to pay for alternative energy like generators and gas. Thuso Khumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Zimbabwe's former finance minister Tendai Biti says a new report that names President Emmerson Mnangagwa and several local and international private companies as members of corrupt cartels merely scratches the surface. The document titled Cartel Power Dynamics in Zimbabwe was written by some of the country's top researchers and academics. At the recent launch of the report at Wits University in Johannesburg, BT said looting of public funds in the country has intensified since the military forced Robert Mugabe out of office in late 2017. Darren Taylor has more.
BT, a lawyer, was finance minister in a government of national unity from 2009 until 2013. He's currently a member of parliament representing the opposition Movement for Democratic Change, serving in the Portfolio Committee on Finance and Economic Development. Not that there's much of that happening these days, says BT.
Before President Mugabe, you had a situation where it was power for the sake of power. The prime motivation of authoritarian consolidation was to retain power. Now you have got a reverse situation where the prime motive of retaining state power is actually to continue accumulation, extraction.
He says corruption flourished under Mugabe, but now under Mnangagwa, it has reached full bloom. BT says the main beneficiaries are the elite of the ruling ZANU-PF party, the military, and a few private firms controlled by the regime's loyalists. ZANU-PF describes the report and BT's assertions as lies. But BT says Zimbabwe's crumbling as those in power steal the country's resources and riches.
Drive the roads of Harare, you'll be shocked. It's like you are in 1923.
Corruption, says BT, is the major cause of Zimbabwe's fragility.
This is not new to Zimbabwe. Look at every other country that is fragile on the African continent. You find this contradiction between huge resources on one hand and huge poverty on the other hand. So you've got an oxymoronic situation of a very poor but rich country.
The World Bank classifies almost half of the country's population as extremely poor. BT says health services collapsed a long time ago, causing rising maternal and infant mortality rates and deaths from diseases. He identifies several commanding heights of graft in Zimbabwe.
The first one is the RBZ, the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe, and the US dollar. The mismanagement of the foreign exchange regime, the bastardization of the multi-currency regime that I introduced as finance minister, and the introduction of the Zimbabwean dollar.
BT explains that Zimbabwe gets about $5 billion of foreign currency every year through imports. That foreign currency, he says, has been commodified.
Anyone who controls that foreign currency, which is the Reserve Bank, and those that are behind the Reserve Bank, means they've got a huge loot of $5 billion. And this has contributed to a massive looting, massive transfer of wealth from the poor to the rich. This has created serious arbitrage.
BT describes the RBZ as a rogue bank responsible for some of Zimbabwe's most heinous illicit financial flows. The bank's directors deny this. Then, says BT, there's the fuel sector, which he brands as the Champions League of corruption in Zimbabwe.
The biggest fuel cartel is a man called Kudata Gwire and his company called Secunda. Together with the Russian mafia called Trafigura, they control the Zimbabwean pipeline.
Tagwarai, who Washington has placed under sanctions for his alleged activities, is a close business associate of Mnangagwa's. Tagwarai and Trafigura deny claims they're involved in graft. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A new project has sharply reduced the water outages that have plagued Bulawayo, Zimbabwe's second largest city, and led to some deaths from contaminated water. Arigando gives us the story.
The project to upgrade Bulawayo's water system is nearly complete and on track to be done in December. Bulawayo officials say the project to replace 40-year-old pumps has already raised capacity to 145 megaliters a day, up from 92 megaliters. The aging water system, combined with the two-year drought that had begun in 2018, forced the city government to implement 144 hours of rolling water outages a week in Bulawayo and its suburbs. The problems led to several deaths from tainted water since February. However, the new pumps have allowed the city to reduce outages to 48 hours a week, and it is gradually moving to 24 hours of water supply. The African Development Bank provided US$37 million for the Bulawayo Water and Sewerage Services Improvement Project. This week, bank officials toured the project and city engineer Simela Dube showed off some of the upgrades.
Impact on the community is that there are areas that were not getting water in the past. Even if we're treating at maximum capacity. Within the project, we had water mains upgrading. Like areas like Pumula South, they're now getting water almost continuously, except when there's infrastructure breakages in the area. Mganini, similarly, those gaps have been eliminated through this intervention.
The Bulawayo Progressive Residents Association welcomed the near completion of the pump installation. Tembelane Dube of the association says now the pipes that carry the water around the city and suburbs need to be upgraded.
Because right now there are a lot of best pipes that are taking place in the different wards. And therefore we urge the Bulawayo City Council to do a lot in terms of repairs and monitoring these networks so that the residents of Bulawayo can continuously have water, since the dam are good in terms of carrying capacities, because the project included upgrading water and sewer networks. So we expect that money to have been channeled to the right places.
City Simela Dube says fully improving the city's water and sewage system is a US $700 million task, but that only $70 million has been allocated so far. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigwando in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehigis Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays.